Welcome to this first EHIV Review podcast. EHIV Review is presented by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. This program is supported by educational grants from Abbott Laboratories, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and Bristol-Myers Squibb. Today's program is a companion piece to our EHIV Review newsletter, Screening and Management of Older Patients with HIV Infection. Our guest is that issue's author, Dr. Kelly Gibo from Johns Hopkins. This activity has been developed for infectious disease specialists, primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, and other healthcare practitioners whose practice involves treating HIV patients. There are no fees or prerequisites for this activity. The accreditation and credit designation statements can be found at the end of this podcast. For additional information about accreditation, Hopkins policies, expiration dates, and to take the post-test to receive credit online, please go to our website newsletter archive, www.ehivreview.org. and click on the Issue 2 podcast link. Learning objectives for this program are that after participating in this activity, the participant will demonstrate the ability to discuss the screening of older patients for HIV risk factors, explain the issues of polypharmacy in older HIV-infected patients, and describe the impact of disclosure on the older HIV-infected patient. I'm Bob Busker, Managing Editor of EHIV Review. Our guest today is Dr. Kelly Gibo, Associate Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Dr. Gibo has disclosed that she has no relevant financial relationships with any commercial entities specific to her presentation, and that her presentation today will not include discussion of any off-label or unapproved uses of drugs or products. Dr. Gibo, welcome to this EHIV Review podcast.
Thank you for inviting me to be here.
In your newsletter issue, you reviewed important new data about the epidemiology of HIV among older patients, their response to ART, and key issues involved in the management of polypharmacy. What I'd like to do today is focus on how that new information can be applied in clinical practice. So if you would, start us out with a patient, please.
The first patient is a 72-year-old female who presented to her primary care physician with a diagnosis of failure to thrive and fatigue. The patient had been in her usual state of good health until 3 months prior to presentation, at which time she noticed a 10-pound unintentional weight loss. The patient had also been incredibly active in her community and was noticing difficulty in maintaining her activities of daily living, including volunteering in her great-grandson's classroom. Her primary care physician sent off extensive laboratory values, which revealed a mild anemia and a protein gap. He also conducted an evaluation for malignancy, which included a chest, abdomen, and pelvic CT, and colonoscopy, all of which were negative. Her past medical history was significant only for mild hypertension and prior cataract surgery. Her only medication was low-dose hydrochlorothiazide. The patient lived with her daughter, did not use drugs, and was not sexually active. She did not use alcohol or tobacco. She was very active in her great-grandson's classroom and was an active member of her church community. The patient's husband had died a decade earlier of pneumonia. After extensive testing, the patient was diagnosed with HIV. Her CD4 count was 57, and a viral load was over 100,000. Much to the patient and her family's surprise, her RPR also returned positive at a titer of 1 to 8.
What do you consider the most pertinent factors about this case?
This is an interesting case. This patient had classic signs of HIV, including failure to thrive and fatigue, that would have immediately initiated an HIV testing if she had been 40 years younger. Interestingly, at the advanced age of 72, the CDC guidelines don't recommend screening for HIV. However, the patient's history of her husband dying earlier of pneumonia triggered the primary care doctor to send off the HIV test. The patient did not have classic HIV risk factors, as she was not sexually active, nor had she used injection drugs in the past. Of note, most older patients do remain sexually active. In fact, a study from the New England Journal revealed that many men remain sexually active at older ages. A recent study revealed that 84% of men between the ages of 57 and 64 were sexually active, and almost 40% of men between the ages of 75 and 85 were sexually active, defined as having sexual intercourse within the past 12 months. With the use of erectile dysfunction drugs, men are remaining sexually active at much older ages than they were previously. Women are often thought that they're not to be at risk of pregnancy, so they're not using condoms to protect themselves. Given this increased sexual activity, providers need to be comfortable asking their older patients about their sexual history as well as their sexual risk factors in order that they can provide appropriate HIV testing and advice on protecting themselves from additional sexually transmitted infections.
Just a note to our listeners that a link to the New England Journal study Dr. Gibo just mentioned can be found in the transcript version of this podcast. So, Dr. Gibo, talk to us about the potential implications this patient's advanced age might have on her HIV outcomes.
For this particular patient, there are some significant ramifications of her advanced stage of disease. older patients are more likely to achieve immunosuppression at diagnosis because they're often diagnosed at advanced stages of disease. Providers do not screen for HIV in older patients as well as we do in younger patients, and often this means that older patients are diagnosed when their CD4 count is well below 200. Older patients also have less response to antiretroviral therapy once initiated. Although they're more likely to achieve virologic suppression than younger patients, they have less increase in their CD4 count after starting antiretroviral therapy. In fact, an article by Carrie Althoff et al. Showed that older patients have less improvement in their CD4 count at up to 2 years after starting antiretroviral therapy when compared to younger patients. This suggests that even starting antiretroviral therapy may not improve the patient's long-term outcomes as well as it would in a younger patient. Therefore, the recent CDC guidelines have recommended that starting older patients on antiretroviral therapy as soon as they present to care is an important change in our recent management of the older patient infected with HIV.
For the patient you presented to us, when should ART be started and what type of therapy would you recommend starting with?
Well, it's an interesting question. Given the decreased response with CD4 cells in older patients, the recent DHHS guidelines have suggested starting older patients as soon as they present for HIV care. This means that we no longer wait for the CD4 count to fall below 500, and if they present with a higher CD4 count, that they should still be started on antiretroviral therapy as soon as possible. When selecting an antiretroviral therapy for older patients, it's important to think about their comorbid conditions. Patients who have renal insufficiency or other risk factors that place them at risk of renal insufficiency, such as hypertension, diabetes, or cocaine use, may not be the appropriate candidates for tenofovir-based therapies. In addition, we know that many antiretroviral therapies increase the risk of hyperlipidemia and diabetes. Therefore, when managing the older patient with HIV, it's important to think about their comorbid conditions when selecting their first regimen. In addition, it's important to think about side effects and toxicities of antiretrovirals once they're started, and patients should have aggressive screening to make sure that they don't develop these toxicities, and if they do, that their antiretrovirals are discontinued or their regimen changed to avoid long-term toxicity.
What other important points does this case illustrate?
Appropriately, at the time of HIV diagnosis, the patient was screened for syphilis. Her RPR returned positive at 1 to 8. One of the diagnoses in HIV that need to be screened for are neurosyphilis. Given the patient's unknown history of syphilis, it would be appropriate to do a neurologic examination, and if she had any neurologic signs, she should receive a lumbar puncture to rule out neurosyphilis. And if her LP is positive, she should have treatment with IV penicillin. If not, the patient can receive intramuscular penicillin for treatment of late-latent syphilis.
How was this patient treated, and what were the outcomes?
After an extensive discussion with our clinical staff, we had a long conversation about whether this patient should be treated or not. She was elderly, but she was actually doing remarkably well in terms of comorbid conditions, and she was complaining significantly of fatigue and failure to thrive, which we thought were symptomatic of her HIV. Therefore, we decided to begin antiretroviral therapy with a four-drug combination. The patient was subsequently started on AZT, 3TC, Abacavir, and Favrin. Unfortunately, she soon developed hallucinations, and her daughter found her standing in the kitchen trying to stab at a ghost with a knife. We immediately stopped her efavirenz and replaced it with ritonavir-boosted lopinavir. Unfortunately, the patient developed life-threatening hepatitis, and we then had to stop her antiretrovirals again. We had another extensive conversation with the family, and we felt that stopping antiretrovirals was probably in the patient's best interest, given that she had two significant side effects with significant morbidity associated with them. The patient was adamant in her desire to be treated because she wanted to achieve her activities of daily living, and therefore asked for us to consider initiating antiretroviral therapy one more time. Again, we brought this case to our conference, and we discussed what were the pros and cons of starting antiretroviral therapy and decided to give her one more try. We decided to start her on Abacavir, 3TC, and Atazanavir. Remarkably, the patient became undetectable within 3 months, and her viral load remained undetectable, and her CD4 count rose to over 400. The patient did very well for 3 years, going back to volunteering and becoming increasingly active in her church community, and died in her sleep recently at the age of 98 of unknown causes.
Thank you, Dr. Gibo. Let's move on to another patient now, if you would, please.
The second patient for today is a 63-year-old African-American female who has been HIV-infected for approximately 10 years. She's done remarkably well in her antiretroviral therapy with a CD4 count that has been over 500 and a viral load that has been undetectable at less than 50 copies. In fact, her most recent CD4 count was 511 and her HIV-1 RNA was less than 20 copies. Her past medical history is significant for hyperlipidemia, hypertension, chronic hepatitis B, osteoarthritis, a recent diagnosis of lung cancer, which required both lung removal surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, for which she's recovered. The patient's medications are tenofovir, FTC, ritonavir, atazanavir, entecavir, hydrochlorothiazide, pioglitazone, lisinopril, aspirin, and atorvastatin. Unfortunately, this is over 10 pills a day for this patient, which she has significant difficulty in maintaining every day. Of note, her BMI is 30, her most recent systolic blood pressure is over 140, and her hemoglobin A1C is 9.5.
This sounds like a relatively complicated case. To your mind, what are the most important points?
Well, this patient is actually doing remarkably well from an HIV perspective. She's been virologically suppressed with a high CD4 count for over 10 years and has done well despite being on radiation therapy and chemotherapy. Unfortunately, she's not doing well with management of her comorbid conditions. She has poor diabetic control, an elevated BMI, and high blood pressure. All of these are symptoms of her not being able to take her complicated medication regimen appropriately.
This patient has so many comorbid conditions. Do we have any understanding of why?
It's interesting. There have been a number of studies which have suggested that older patients with HIV are acquiring comorbid conditions at an earlier age than seronegative age-matched controls. In fact, a recent study from the Swiss cohort showed that approximately 50% of HIV-infected patients under the age of 50 have no comorbid conditions, but that approximately 75% of patients who are 65 and over have at least one comorbid condition, and approximately 10% have three or more comorbid conditions in addition to their HIV management. It's unclear if this is the result of premature aging, advanced age, or toxicity from antiretroviral treatment. A number of studies are currently ongoing to figure out why older patients with HIV are developing comorbid conditions so commonly. There are many things that we could do to help this patient optimally manage her HIV as well as her other comorbid conditions. And I think we need to think about that when we manage her HIV. There are a number of non-pharmacologic interventions that could help her, including diet, weight loss programs, and improving her exercise, potentially with water aerobic programs, given her osteoarthritis. In addition, the patient is a current smoker, and given her recent history of lung cancer and her predilection for cardiovascular disease, tobacco cessation should be a high priority when managing her other non-HIV-related conditions. In addition, there could be potential interventions to help reduce toxicities, including switching her ART medications if she's likely to develop diabetes from her antiretrovirals.
Something that struck me from the presentation was this patient's pill burden. What can be done to help her with that?
Well, this patient is on a significant number of medications. In fact, she's on 10 pills per day. The patient had difficulty taking all of her medications at one time. And when we sat down and looked at her regimen, we were able to take some of her pills to be taken in the morning and some of her pills to be taken in the afternoon, which certainly helped with her adherence. In addition, we got her family involved with helping her because we have found that family support is always helpful when trying to help patients with improving their adherence. In addition, it's important to address in non-threatening ways why she may have been having difficulties taking her medications. For some patients, cost is a significant issue. And as patients age and are enrolling in Medicare, this is something we need to keep in mind. In addition, there could potentially be drug-drug interactions or side effects or toxicities that she's experiencing, which may affect her adherence to these medications. In addition, many patients are on multiple times daily dosing regimens, which can complicate their adherence to these antiretrovirals as well as their other medications used to treat comorbid conditions. Therefore, one needs to be cognizant when prescribing antiretrovirals and other medications on the frequency as well as the drug-drug interactions of these medications and how they interact. Finally, it's important to try to keep the medication regimens as simple as possible. Reducing the number of pills and reducing the number of times per day that patients need to take their medications can significantly improve adherence. As providers, if we can do this, we can significantly improve long-term clinical outcomes.
Let's look at her pill burden from a different perspective. Does she need to take all these medications, and if not, how would you determine which ones can be stopped?
That's a very important question. Particularly when this patient was undergoing chemotherapy, we did a strict evaluation to see which medications were essential for her and which ones could potentially be stopped given the significant nausea she had with her chemotherapy. We kept her HIV and her hepatitis B drugs going. However, we did give her a break in terms of managing her hyperlipidemia and with her aspirin therapy. This reduced the overall number of pills the patient was taking per day and significantly improved her adherence to the other ones. After her chemotherapy was stopped and the patient had improvement in her nausea, we were able to restart all the medications without any difficulty. I think as providers, we need to evaluate at each visit how many medicines the patient's taking, are they all essential, and are there any medications that could potentially be stopped without significant harm to the patient.
And we'll return with Dr. Kelly Giebel from Johns Hopkins in just a moment.
Hello, I'm Richard Moore, professor of medicine in the divisions of infectious diseases and general internal medicine, and director of the Johns Hopkins Hospital HIV Clinic. I'm one of the program directors of eHIV Review. eHIV Review is a combination newsletter and podcast program delivered via email to subscribers. Newsletters are published every other month. Each issue reviews the current literature in areas of importance to infectious disease specialists, primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, and other healthcare practitioners whose work or practice includes treating HIV patients. Bi-monthly podcasts are also available as downloadable transcripts, providing case-based scenarios to help bring that new clinical information into practice in the exam room and at the bedside. Subscription to eHIV Review is provided without charge or prerequisite. Continuing education credit for each issue and each podcast is provided by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. For more information on this educational activity, to subscribe and receive eHIV Review without charge and access back issues, please go to our website, www.ehivreview.org.
Welcome back to this eHIV Review podcast. I'm Bob Busker, Managing Editor of the program. Our guest is Dr. Kelly Gibo, Associate Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology at Johns Hopkins. And our topic is screening and management of older patients with HIV. We've been discussing how the information Dr. Gibo presented in her newsletter issue can be translated into clinical practice. So to continue along those lines, Dr. Gibo, bring us another patient, if you would, please.
Our next patient is a 77-year-old female who has had HIV for approximately 5 years. Her most recent CD4 count is 500, and her viral load has been undetectable most of the time. However, we did notice that she had several blips per year, occurring often around the holidays. The patient's past medical history is significant for mild hypertension and an arrhythmia with AICD placement and depression. The patient's medications are tenofovir, FTC, efavirenz, carvedilol, hydrochlorothiazide, paroxetine, and pravastatin. She's the caretaker for her 3 grandchildren. Her husband died in 2008. She uses no tobacco, alcohol, or drugs, and is currently working 2 jobs so that she can have enough money for food for her 3 growing teenage grandchildren. Her family is unaware of her HIV diagnosis, and this significantly impacts her adherence to antiretroviral therapy. The patient is fearful that her family will find out her diagnosis and has been unwilling to discuss it with her family. When she travels to her daughter's house for the holidays, the patient takes 1 pill bottle with all of her pills in it and labels it blood pressure pills.
Interesting patient dynamics, doctor. What was your approach to this case?
This patient is very interesting in that her CD4 count is elevated. However, she's not being optimally managed. She's had multiple virologic blips, most often after visiting family from out of town. Upon further questioning, the patient admits that she puts all of her pills in a container labeled blood pressure and takes them randomly while out of town so that her family does not know her condition. The patient reports that she is very afraid of her family finding out about her diagnosis and removing her grandchildren from her care. After multiple discussions with the patient, she agrees to have a joint family meeting where we disclose her HIV status. The patient and her daughter came into the exam room, and we had a long conversation. I asked the daughter why she thought her mother was presenting for care, and she said this is where she has her blood pressure and her high cholesterol treated. I agreed, and then asked her if she knew any other medical conditions her mother had. The daughter said no. Ultimately, I disclosed that the patient had HIV in addition to her hypertension. The daughter seemed non-fazed by this entire experience. The mother turned to her and said, "You knew I had HIV?" And the daughter said, "Of course we knew you had HIV. Dad died of HIV about 10 years ago. We all assumed that you did. Why did you hide it from us?" At this point, the mother and daughter began to cry, and it became entirely clear to the mother that both the daughter and her family knew about her diagnosis. After this point, the patient was far more adherent to antiretroviral therapy. The family became engaged in helping the patient to develop both advanced directives and an end-of-life care plan for when she ultimately died. In addition, it allowed for discussion about what to happen with the grandchildren at her death. This was significantly relieving to the patient and her family because for the first time they were able to have open conversations, which led to both development of end-of-life treatment care plans, which were important for me to know, as well as improved discussion with the family and ultimately improved clinical outcomes because the patient was able to discuss and disclose her HIV status with her entire family. As you can imagine, we were all feeling very relieved by the time we exited the room. Disclosure is an important issue with older HIV-infected patients. They're often reluctant to disclose their HIV status because they're afraid of being discriminated against by their local community or by their families. They're afraid of losing contact with their children and their grandchildren, and we have found that families are far more supportive of the diagnosis once it's made than the patients are thinking it will be. In fact, we've developed patient support groups for our patients who are over the age of 50 to help them disclose their HIV status to their families and have found this to be a very helpful group of people to help our patients with this important conversation. Ultimately, we have found that disclosure is significantly improved and helps with both their current management as well as their end-of-life care. I would encourage providers to have these conversations when patients are well and to try to help patients develop conversations with their families so that disclosure can be made requiring hospitalization or end-of-life care to be determined when families may not know their ultimate HIV status.
An excellent illustration, doctor. What was the final outcome with this patient?
Well, remarkably, the patient's been virologically suppressed 100% of the time since his disclosure. The family has been very engaged in helping the patient with her HIV status and with managing the grandchildren, which she had difficulty financially beforehand. Ultimately, I think this conversation has improved both the patient's clinical well-being as well as her psychosocial well-being, and has been very helpful for me as a physician because now I have not only the patient but her family to rely on for providing additional information for this patient. It also helped with dealing with medical power of attorney and advance directives before a catastrophic illness occurred, and I think ultimately this will help the patient with her long-term mental well-being because she knows that her end-of-life wishes will be met when needed.
Thank you, Doctor. If you would please, bring us one last case.
Sure. The last case today is a 77-year-old Caucasian gentleman who has had HIV for over 20 years. He's done remarkably well with his antiretroviral therapy. He has a CD4 count of over 750 and has been virologically suppressed for over 15 years, with his most recent viral load being less than 20 copies. His past medical history is only significant for mild depression and hepatitis C infection. His current medications are abacavir, lamivudine, ritonavir, and atazanavir. The patient lives alone. He's divorced. He has sex with other men. He has 2 children and 4 grandchildren whom he visits regularly. He uses no tobacco, occasional alcohol, and has rare crack use. He had done remarkably well until January 2011 when there was an ice storm in Baltimore and he went out to walk his dog. Unfortunately, he slid on his stairs, fell down, and broke a number of bones requiring a prolonged hospitalization.
And the most important points of this case, Doctor?
Well, this patient has been optimally managed from an HIV perspective with long-term virologic suppression and immune reconstitution on a well-tolerated regimen. He's had optimal lipid management, his blood pressure is well-controlled, and he's not using any tobacco. Unfortunately, he's susceptible to other comorbid conditions because of his increased age and potentially because of his HIV infection. In addition, he's continuing to use crack cocaine, which is putting him at high risk of non-adherence to his antiretrovirals as well as other significant comorbid conditions.
This patient does have some high-risk behaviors. What can you advise clinicians about how to best screen their older patients for those?
That's a very important question, and I encourage providers to ask all of their patients between the ages of 12 and 112 about any sexual activity. Are they engaging in oral, anal, or vaginal sex with men, women, or both? And are they using any type of protection when having these activities? I also encourage providers to ask about alcohol use, tobacco use, and any drug use. This patient is 77 years old and would not be one that you would automatically think of as using crack cocaine. However, when I asked, he readily admitted it. I think as providers, we often are uncomfortable asking people who look like our parents or grandparents about sexual activity or injection drug use. And until we become comfortable with it, patients will never be comfortable. Once we are comfortable ourselves asking in a very non-threatening, non-judgmental way, patients often provide answers which are very helpful and can help improve the delivery of the care that we provide to these patients. This patient appeared to be a low-risk patient. He was doing well from a laboratory perspective. However, on further questioning, his social history revealed both unprotected anal intercourse and crack use. Approximately 40% of men over 75 report being sexually active, and this number is likely to increase with the use of erectile dysfunction drugs. Therefore, it's very important for all of our providers to be comfortable when screening patients on their sexual and drug history. And it's also imperative to intervene and have services to offer our patients who are engaging in these high-risk behaviors.
Now, this patient had some serious injuries from his fall. Do you think his HIV status or his comorbid conditions might have contributed to the severity of those injuries?
Well, it's interesting. Older HIV-infected patients have been shown to be at risk of both osteoporosis and fractures. And there have been a number of studies suggesting that both age and HIV infection may predispose patients to being at increased risk of fractures. Older patients should be screened for osteoporosis. In fact, current recommendations are for DEXA screening for all postmenopausal women as well as HIV-infected men ages 50 and over. In addition, there's other age-appropriate interventions that HIV-infected patients should have. There should be cancer screening that should remain consistent with the American Cancer Society screening guidelines. In addition, sexually active older adults should be screened for sexually transmitted infections, preferably twice annually if they're engaging in high-risk behaviors. In addition, they should avoid comorbid diseases. Patients should be vaccinated with influenza and strep pneumonia vaccines to prevent both flu and pneumonia when appropriate. For patients who are smoking, tobacco cessation is an important intervention to help reduce long-term clinical adverse outcomes. In addition, all patients should be encouraged to engage in exercise and to follow an appropriate diet. Providers should be vigilant to screen for hyperlipidemia and to treat lipids when appropriate, as well as to screen for hypertension and to treat this appropriately as well. In addition, when present, we need to better treat comorbid diseases, particularly osteoporosis and hepatitis C infection. In fact, this patient had undergone previous treatment for his hepatitis C with interferon and ribavirin. Unfortunately, he developed virologic rebound after stopping his therapy and is now considering other options now that the new hepatitis C drugs are available. Finally, it's important to address psychosocial issues and advance directives in clinic when things are calm rather than waiting for a catastrophic event to occur. Thankfully, this patient had addressed these ahead of time, and although we did not need his advanced directives, I did have information on how to contact his family, which was very helpful when the patient was brought in by ambulance. Both the patient and his children were grateful that we were able to get in contact with them, and they were able to meet with him in the emergency room as soon as the event had occurred.
Thank you for those cases, Dr. Gibo. I'd like to shift gears now. Let me ask if your overall thoughts on the whole topic of HIV infection in the elderly and what we can expect to find happening in the future.
That's a very interesting question. HIV in the elderly wasn't a topic that was of high priority approximately a decade ago. However, given the graying of the epidemic and the new infections we're seeing in older patients, it's achieved increased publicity both in the lay press as well as in the scientific community. In fact, the White House recently had a National HIV and Aging Awareness Day, which was co-sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, where they invited a number of physicians and community activists to come and talk about the issues of HIV in the older population. In addition, the NIH Office of AIDS Research recently issued a request for proposals on the topic of HIV and aging because it's become an increasingly important topic in the HIV community. In addition, there's now an international workshop on HIV and aging. In fact, the third international workshop will be in Baltimore in November of 2012. Also, in terms of the lay press, there's been increased publicity with one of the recent characters on the show Brothers and Sisters being an older man who was recently diagnosed with HIV and coming to terms with both his diagnosis as well as how to disclose this to his family. So I think this topic of HIV and aging is finally gaining the recognition at which it really needs. Unfortunately, there's some things that we still don't know. In fact, there's a number of areas for future research, such as how do we prioritize comorbid disease treatment in HIV-infected older patients? In addition, should we screen for and treat comorbid conditions more aggressively in HIV-infected older patients than we do among those without HIV infection? I think these are some of the questions that we are looking to answer. In fact, there was a recent document published by the American Academy of HIV Medicine as well as the American Geriatric Society called the HIV and Aging Guidance Project, which tried to delineate some of the important principles of HIV management in the older patient. While this document is kept online, it's also being updated on a monthly basis. So as new studies come out, providers can use this to try to obtain the most recent information on management of the older patient. In addition, as we discussed, the DHHS guidelines issued in March of 2012 now suggest treatment changes for the management of older patients, including initiating ART for all patients over the age of 50, regardless of their CD4 count. They also recommend that ART-associated adverse events occur more frequently in older patients, and therefore screening for bone, kidney, metabolic, cardiovascular, and liver-related health of older HIV-infected patients should be monitored closely. They also note that drug-drug interactions should be assessed regularly, particularly when new drugs are added to the patient's regimen. And HIV experts and primary care providers should work together to optimize the medical care of older HIV-infected patients with complex comorbidities. Finally, the DHHS guidelines recommended counseling to prevent secondary transmission of HIV, as this is an important aspect of long-term care for this older HIV-infected population. I think we've made a lot of progress in the management of HIV in the older patient, but we still have a lot of ground to cover. I think that we'll have a lot more information in the next 5 years, including what are potentially the optimal regimens to treat older patients with, as well as more information about potential drug-drug interactions that we should be careful of in our older HIV-infected population.
A link to that HIV and Aging Guidance Project website Dr. Gibo mentioned can be found in the transcript version of this podcast. What I'd like to do now, Doctor, is review the key points of our discussion today. Let's start with explaining the need for screening older individuals for HIV risk factors.
Well, the current CDC guidelines recommend screening for HIV in patients between the ages of 13 and 64. As we know, older patients continue to engage in high-risk behaviors, including sexual activity and drug use. And I think it's important to keep in mind that we need to ask patients about these behaviors and continue to screen patients who are engaging in these high-risk behaviors, even if they are above the age of 64.
The issues of polypharmacy in older HIV-infected patients.
Well, we know that our older patients have many comorbid conditions and are often taking multiple medications for these conditions. Patients who are taking multiple medications are more likely to suffer from non-adherence because of difficulties taking their medications together, as well as potentially drug-drug interactions. I think as providers, we need to be aware of this and try to identify medications that patients may no longer need, as well as potentially significant drug-drug interactions that need to be avoided when prescribing medications to these older patients.
And finally, the impact of disclosure of HIV status for older patients.
Older patients with HIV are often reluctant to disclose their HIV status to their families and friends because of fear of isolation. They don't want to be cut off because of their HIV diagnosis. Fortunately, what we have found clinically is that after disclosing their HIV status, most families and churches are actually welcoming of patients and have been very helpful in helping them improve their long-term clinical outcomes because they can help them with taking their medications more appropriately, as well as helping them get to clinic for their visits. In addition, once patients have disclosed their HIV status, it makes the planning with advanced directives and end-of-life care far easier as patients are not afraid of their families finding out about their HIV diagnosis after their death. I think this can improve the patient's mental well-being, as well as improve discussions with the family and help planning for appropriate end-of-life care.
Dr. Kelly Gibo from the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, thank you for participating in this EHIV Review podcast.
Thank you for having me and giving me the ability to discuss this very important topic of HIV in the older population.
This podcast is presented in conjunction with the EHIV Review newsletter, a peer-reviewed, CME-certified literature review emailed monthly to clinicians treating patients with HIV. The Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. For physicians, the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine designates this enduring material for a maximum of 0.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in this activity. This educational resource is provided without charge, but registration is required. To register to receive EHIV Review via email, please go to our website, www.ehivreview.org. The opinions and recommendations expressed by faculty and other experts whose input is included in this program are their own. This enduring material is produced for educational purposes only. Use of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine name implies review of educational format, design, and approach. Please review the complete prescribing information for specific drugs, combinations of drugs, or use of medical equipment, including indications, contraindications, warnings, and adverse effects, before administering therapy to patients. EHIV Review is supported by educational grants from Abbott Laboratories, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and Bristol-Myers Squibb. Thank you for listening. This program is copyright 2012, with all rights reserved by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.